Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda Racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com. F1 drivers are extraordinary. Their competitive spirit, combined with their ability to control a racing car on the limit at 200 miles an hour, sets them apart from the rest of us. If they lose control, if they crash, even if they get hurt, there's only one thing on their minds. They want to get back in the car and race again. Carl Wendlinger has no memory of his career-defining accident at Monaco in 1994. But he does remember how determined he was to get back in an F1 car.
The whole July, I said, I want to continue racing. Then I said, once to the doctor, when can I go home? And I said, not now. Why? Because I want to get fit to do racing again. Huh? It was like a little child, you know. I want to do racing again. I want to do racing again. Maybe this also accelerated a little bit the improvement that I got better and better.
Carl did make an incredible return, but he quickly realized that something had changed.
It would have been a big drama for me with not being able to get the comeback. This would have destroyed me mentally completely. But then I tried it, I got the chance, I couldn't confirm it with good performance. Maybe I was nervous, maybe I was whatever. I was just not fast enough. Somehow I got the impression this is my way of life. And somehow a great Formula One career was not part of my life.
Welcome everyone, I'm Tom Clarkson and this is F1 Beyond the Grid. Carl Wendlinger's Formula One career was very much a case of what might have been. A product of the Mercedes Junior program alongside Michael Schumacher and Heinz-Harald Frentzen, Carl was surrounded by greatness when he made his Formula One debut at the end of 1991. During one of the sport's most iconic eras, he raced against Schumacher, Ayrton Senna, Nigel Mansell and Mika Hakkinen. But the Austrian was never able to fulfill his potential following a career-changing accident at Monaco in 1994. In first practice, Carl lost control under braking for the Nouvelle chicane and crashed broadside into a barrier. He was in a coma for nearly 3 weeks and took many months to regain a level of fitness suitable for Formula One. He eventually returned for Sauber at the 1995 Spanish Grand Prix. But a poor performance saw him benched to give him more time to recover. One last chance presented itself at the final two races of 95, but they proved to be his last in F1. Carl talks in great detail about Monaco 94, what he remembers, what he doesn't remember, and why he still doesn't understand how the crash happened. We also discuss his long recuperation, how he came to terms with the end of his F1 dream, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Carl, it is fantastic to have you on the show. Thank you for your time. How are things?
Thank you very much for the invitation. Oh, things are good.
You are a Mercedes ambassador. I think you do a lot of driver training as well. Just tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I'm since 12 years now together with Mercedes-AMG as a brand ambassador, but also being part of a lot of car driving events, on-road driving over a few days from hotel to hotel, but also daily tours at Affalterbach, the home base of AMG, and also some events with the Mercedes Classic Department, for example, in Italy in June, the Mille Miglia, and, you know, events like this all over the year.
What do you get to drive in the Mille Miglia, for example?
Last year, I started the first day with SL Galving, and then they changed me to the SS Prevost together with the, made, I think, in 1930, together with Mr. Breitschwert, the CEO of the Classic Department.
So it's all classic stuff. Do you ever get the chance to test something modern? I mean, what chance you driving last year's W14 Mercedes Formula One car?
No chance. No chance. I wouldn't fit, I guess, anymore. And second, I wouldn't have the, you know, not the fitness to drive the car.
Let's look back on your own career now. 5 years in Formula One in the early 1990s. How do you reflect on that time now?
I enjoyed the time in Formula One a lot. And I still remember very much my first event or my first race. 1991 Suzuka, second last race of the season. I got a seat at Leighton House. Leighton House got problems with budget. I had a small sponsor, so I replaced Ivan Capelli in the Leighton House. And this was my first Formula One event. Yes, and I still remember I was just happy and enjoyed very much to be there and achieved my future goal, which was for a long time to be Formula One driver.
And what a place to make your debut. I mean, the Suzuka circuit is one of the greats in the world, isn't it?
It is absolutely good atmosphere. And at this time still, Ayrton Senna, Alain Prost, all the big stars. And when you go out behind them out of the pit lane the first time, yes, it was a very good feeling. And I still remember very well.
Carl, you were part of the Mercedes Junior program. We'll come on to that in a bit. But, you know, there was the three of you, the three musketeers, if you like, yourself, Michael Schumacher, and Heinz-Harald Frentzen. And Schumacher had made his debut a little bit earlier in the year with Jordan. Did you get asked to drive that Jordan? Were you getting frustrated that it was Schumacher had got the drive in F1 and you hadn't at that point?
No, I didn't get frustrated because of that. I mean, somehow we became Mercedes-Benz Juniors end of 1989 after the Formula 3 season in Germany, what we did together. And we were the first three, finishing the first three. But I think this was not really the reason that they just took us. They didn't say, okay, who is number one, first, second, and third at the end of the year? And these three guys we take as a junior program. I got invited already in August from Mr. Merpasch, the motorsport director of Mercedes-Benz, to come to Stuttgart in the factory and have a chat with him. And then he explained me the whole thing. He invited me then at the end of August, I believe, to a Group C race in Spa-Francorchamps to watch everything a little bit and meet the people from the team, etc. And then, yeah, we did testing over the winter. We got the chance to do a few races together with Jochen Maas. And then in 1991, Michael Schumacher and myself, we shared a car in the whole championship. And of course, I heard always again rumors, maybe there's a chance to move into Formula One. Maybe Michael is already in discussions with a team who wanted to get him. But then everything was quite secret. And when then the news came out that he will do Spa-Francorchamps, I was happy for him. They also told me, when you have time, go to the Formula One races just to show up there and present yourself a little bit. And I think the first race in 1991 was Silverstone. Was in the paddock. This time, I mean, would have been necessary to sell yourself there, to contact the people, to talk to the people. But I didn't talk. I was very shy, so it didn't help really a lot to stand around all day long in Silverstone paddock. But at least I was there. Then I went to Barcelona. I also went to Monza, and there a guy from Marlboro, I can't remember his name, said to me, come with me, we go to Leighton House garage and jump in the car if you can fit in this car.
And that's when that looked like it could become a reality.
Yes, and then I said, why is it? There's maybe some budget problem with Leighton House, but at least we know now that you can fit in the car.
Because you are quite tall. You're, what, 185?
87, yeah.
And the Leighton House of 91 was an Adrian Newey car.
No, not anymore. I think the car was made from, I think.
Was it Gustav Brunner?
Gustav was there. Chris Murphy, I think, was designing the car. And I think the Adrian Newey Leighton House was 1990. I think this car I could not fit.
I was going to say, because Adrian doesn't like tall racing drivers, does he? They get in the way.
No, and in the 91 car, I fitted in the car, I could drive the car, but at this time it was still a H6-speed gearbox. And in Suzuka, for example, and then also in Adelaide, the race, the last race of the season, it was very difficult for me to change into second gear. The second was nearly not possible because my elbow was blocked from the at the chassis, etc.
So what did you do? Just go first to third?
No, somehow I got it in, but it was not very comfortable.
Not very quick, probably. You probably lost a bit of time.
I lost time, yeah. But still, this Suzuka, their numbers on the result page, and of course, there's my story about it. And in Suzuka, I was quite competitive. Let us say like this. On Saturday morning, because at this time it was still Formula One, they still had qualifying tires. And on Saturday morning, every driver got a qualifying set to practice the qualifying for the afternoon. I was 10th on the grid. I was not 10th on the grid. I was 10th fastest in the free practice. And then Saturday afternoon, at my first try, already half of the circuit, I was 8/10 faster than in the morning lap. But then gearbox broke. And so I had to jump in the spare car. I had less space in the car because this was all settled for Mauricio Kuschelmin. So somehow I qualified for the race. But without this problem in my car, without the gearbox problem, maybe it could have been quite a good result at my first Formula One race of the career. On the other hand, there was always again something when I tried. So maybe, I know.
How good a preparation was the Mercedes sports car program for Formula One? Did you have things like qualifying tires in sports cars? Because that would have helped. And powerful cars, but heavy cars in sports cars. Just how well prepared did you feel?
I think it was a very good preparation for us. We didn't have qualifying tires. That was normal. I think in qualifying, we used just a new set of race tires. They were powerful cars. Okay, you said more weight in Formula One. But on the other hand, we had quite a lot of downforce, and there was a high speed in the fast corners. There was a good downforce under braking and so on. And this was, of course, not the same than Formula One, but it came it quite close. So it was a good preparation for the first time to be in Formula One.
But also those first two races that you mentioned in 91, Suzuka ended early. Then in Adelaide, we had the monsoon. So I think the race ended after 14 laps or something. Did you go into that winter thinking, help, I haven't learned very much yet? I still feel like a rookie, despite having two races.
Absolutely. I did two races. But like you said, Suzuka ended after one lap. And in Adelaide, I was not competitive, first of all. And second, I mean, I qualified for the race. And then there was this monsoon. And I think I stopped with misfire. Before they stopped the race, I stopped already because there was a big misfire on the car. So I didn't get a lot of experience with these two races. Then, okay, I flew home and, okay, still stayed in contact with the team. But they said, of course, if you want to join us for 1992, we need budget sponsorship. I didn't find a lot of sponsorship, honestly, over the winter time, but I still signed a contract.
With Leighton House.
With March then. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Did you talk to anyone else that winter?
Yeah, we talked Helmut Marko, Dr. Helmut. He was my manager at this time. We also went to Tyrrell.
Tyrrell.
And we talked with Ken Tyrrell and his son, Bob, I believe. And I believe team manager Rupert Manwaring was there as well. And he showed us a little bit the company, the factory, etc. But they asked for so much money that we immediately said, this we will never find this budget.
You mentioned Helmut Marko. Just before we go on, tell us about your relationship with him. A lot of people listening will, you know, be very familiar with the name after the dominance that Red Bull have had in recent seasons in current Formula One. What was Helmut like back then? How did he help you?
He was a tough guy always. But on the other hand, he was, after, you know, having his accident there in Clermont-Ferrand with losing an eye, quite early afterwards, he started his own race team in Austria, supporting young drivers where he believed there's talent enough to support him. I had quite a good relationship to Gerhard Berger. He grew up more or less in the same city than I did. He was 10 years older, but when he started racing in 1981 in the Alpha Suit Cup, my father was driving these things. So he came to my father and said, oh, can you help me there? What should I do to start there to be part of this championship, Alpha Suit Cup? And so I knew Gerhard. And Gerhard then said, okay, when you start racing, I try to help you a little bit. And then the first year I did racing was 1987 with a Formula Ford 1600. We prepared on our own. We had a small truck to go to the races. Gerhard made the contact to Helmut Marko for me. And Helmut, I went to Graz at the end of 1987, chat with him, and he said, yeah, Wendlinger doesn't look so bad, but now we need some sponsorship if you want to do Formula 3. And then with the help of Gerhard, we have found a sponsor. And then I was in Helmut Marko's Formula 3 team. It was a single car team, Herald Alfa Romeo, the only Herald in the championship, I believe, and the only Alfa engine in the championship, with no testing really before the first race. And he said to me immediately, I mean, the only thing what counts is performance. If you test or not, I don't care about it. You have to show performance. The first two races was not so good. Then he put the pressure even tighter. And then from the third race, I remember in Nürburgring, it was working quite well. I mean, we were not on the podium this first season. He thought that I'm improving, and he thought that, the performance is quite okay. And then the relationship was good with him. The only thing what he doesn't like is when you have crashed, when you destroy something, or when you are just too slow.
He is a tough taskmaster. And a lot of the junior program drivers now are quite intimidated by him. They say that he rings at 7 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And if he thinks you haven't done a good enough job, he tells you. And was it the same with you?
It was the same. But on the other hand, he also, when I showed good performance then, he also came and said, it was good, huh? I'm happy about it. But you know, there was one thing when you say they were all afraid when he's calling. The workshop was in Graz. It's around 3.5 hours driving from my home, Kufstein. Huh? Quite often on Sunday afternoon, the telephone rang. I mean, mobile phones were not existing at this time, so it was a home phone. And Helmut was on the phone and said, okay, Karl, tomorrow 9 o'clock workshop, Graz. And I said, why? Because you have to do some work there. I said, when he calls again, I have to do this trip to Graz again. I don't like. I said to my mother, Sunday afternoon, when Mr. Marko calls, say, I'm not at home. Huh? He said, I was not at home. Okay, I didn't have to go on Monday to Graz. I think he did this 2 or 3 times. And the third time he said then, okay, Mrs. Wendlinger, tell your son, if he is next Sunday again not available, if his season is over.
You answered next
then
Sunday.
Then I was in Graz again.
He's had a phenomenal career, has old Helmut. But that first Formula 3 season, I think you said you had the Alfa Romeo engine when everyone winning had a VW, didn't they?
Yes, a VW. Yeah, did this so time. The engine was good. The torque was not the best compared to the VW. And maybe also the 88 RALT chassis was not as good as maybe the Reynard or the Dallara. But then the 89 RALT was a very competitive car, for example.
And do you feel that the relationship with Helmut and Gerhard, without those two people, you wouldn't have made it to Formula One? Is that a fair comment?
Yes, it's a fair comment. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And how are your relations with both of them today?
Still very good. I mean, I don't see them a lot. I mean, we don't have a lot of contact. I will not forget that they helped me a lot in my career. I mean, I cannot give them anything back, but it's still I will honor it always that they helped me.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
So that 92 season, you stay with March and things start very strongly for you, don't they, in Kailami?
Yeah, it started strongly. You know, it was a little bit, how can I say, then I finally got the contract for March. Like I said, mobile phones were not existing. A fax came to my home and saying, okay, next week, Tuesday, testing in Silverstone. Huh? I bought a plane ticket, went to Silverstone. They got me from the airport. Then we to Heathrow. They got me from the airport. Then Silverstone testing, went out of the installation lab, came back again, went out again. And after 2 laps, I saw, I think on the pit board, the spark to come in. showed me, come into the pits. And I came in and said to Gustav Brunner, yeah, a little bit understeer in slow corners. He said to me, this all you can tell me in KL Army because we stopped testing now again because we have no money. Yeah? So I think the whole preparation for the 92 season were 5 laps in Silverstone.
So it makes KL Army even more phenomenal.
Yeah. And then I came to KL Army. And you know, at this time, I think there was still pre-qualifying, I believe. We didn't have to do with March, Leightonhouse March. We didn't have March at this time. We didn't have to do pre-qualifying. And everybody said to me, so the German talk-speaking journalists, the Austrian journalists, the German ones, yeah, nice that you're here, but you will never qualify because you didn't have an old car. They didn't have the money to build a new car. So it was a 91 car we used in 92. You did no testing, so on. And then I said, oh, okay, at least I try my best and then we will see. And then I was 7th on the grid. Huh? So sometimes it's good to expect nothing, and then a lot of things happen. Huh?
How did you keep yourself sharp over the winter? You're not able to test.
No.
So what, fitness and just reflexes? And
only fitness a bit in the gym. Because at this time, I also was my own fitness trainer. I did a little bit of weightlifting. I went running and jogging and so on. And always with the question mark, if I even will start the season, because for a long time it was not fit, not sure. But I always believed in it, and somehow it happened then that I got this contract. Also with the help of Mercedes. Huh?
So Mercedes was still very involved?
Yes, because at this time it was still, I don't know if the beginning of 1992, it was already decided that Sauber can start with Mercedes' help in 1993, but they were, you know, working on it.
And did you know early in 92 that you were going to be back with Sauber in 93?
Maybe early in 92 not, but I believe around May, June 92, I knew that Sauber will be on the grid in 1993 because they called me then. I still had a Mercedes-Benz contract for 1992 and they called me once and said, please come to the workshop to Hinwil and make a seat fitting in a wooden chassis to see if everything works with you in the car or not. And then, of course, I knew that the start for this project was given. And then they told me maybe in September, October, we will have the first test session.
And how different was the Sauber of 1993 in Formula One to the one that you'd been racing with in sports cars? Was it a much bigger team or was it still very similar?
It was not so much bigger because just, I think, last year when I met the last time Mr. Sauber, I always believed when he started his Formula One team, he had around 100 people working for him. And he said, no, it was 66. We did the Formula 3 season 1993 with 66 people working for him.
How do you produce such a competitive car in Formula One with those resources? I've no idea.
The basic of the car was very good. The time difference between the cars were a lot bigger than now. I don't know, 1 or 2 years ago, a guy sent me a stick, a USB stick with the qualifying from Imola 1993. And I was 5th on the grid. But I was 2.5 seconds slower than Boston pole position. 5th on the grid. And Ayrton Senna, I believe, was 3rd and he was 1.7 seconds slower than Boston. And then you just got your qualifying right and maybe you did a good lap, then you just moved in maybe a bit further on the front.
And if you're 2.5 seconds off pole now, you're last.
Yeah, this was different at this time. Huh?
Those early 90s, Carl, was a phenomenal time all the same. When you think of the drivers that were in the sport then, Senna, Prost, Mansell, all these names, some of those great cars as well, the Williamses, the McLarens. It was a great era, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was a great era. Even when there was a bit bigger difference between the cars, huh? It was interesting to watch, I believe, because you had the front group, you had the middle group, and you had a group at the end, and they all were fighting against each other. You had a lot more cars not finished the races because of reliability problems, etc. And so everything was a little bit more mixed up, I believe, than it is now.
And as a driver, how different was your approach, do you think, going into a race back then? Did you always have reliability in the back of your mind in terms of how you were changing gear and looking after the brakes and... Whereas now I feel they're being instructed by the pit wall a lot now. But if they could, it would be qualifying laps every lap.
With Sauber then, we had a pedal shift. So, you know, just press the pedal. There you cannot really look after the gearbox a lot. But in March, it was still, in 1992, a 6-speed H gearbox. And of course, you know, when you're changing down, brake and flipping the throttle to get the gears down, to save the gearbox, but also to neutral a little bit the, how can I say, the revs from the engine and the rear axle, not having locking wheels and so on. So it was a little bit more work to do. But on the other hand, it was also a lot slower in lap times and cornering speed and everything.
And how did you and JJ Leto rub along together in 93 at Sauber?
We were not best friends.
Just what? Because the rivalry was
yeah, too the rivalry.
Intense.
We were young and ego and rivalry, and then we had a small collision in Monaco race and so on. So JJ was in general was a great guy, and then it was okay.
How do you feel you evolved and grew as a driver in that 93 season?
Yes, being involved in the team, but everything was a bit different than it's now, I believe. I mean, there were no simulators available. Okay, we did the testing. Hours for telephone calls with my race engineer at this time. But even the data recording and everything was a lot more simple than it's than it is now. Huh? And still, I would say, qualifying or setting the car on the weekend, it was still, is handwork the right pronouncing in English? I mean, I remember Imola, we were fifth on the grid. We were playing around with the Packers, with the bump rowers, with the roll bars, with a used set of tire, going out again, try something, come back again. So I think it was a lot in the hand of the race engineer together with his driver to find a good setup.
And what do you think was your greatest strength?
I think I could quite good explain to the race engineer what the car was doing on the circuit.
I was chatting to Beat Zender recently, and I mentioned that you and I were going to have a chat. And he said, oh, send Cole my best regards and all that. But he also said that when he thinks of you, he says there are very few drivers that have been through Sauber who had that level of intensity that you had. He said a guy that reminds him of you is Robert Kubica. He said Robert was the sort of guy, very quick, but was wanting more and more information the whole time. He would take sheets of paper back to the hotel in the evenings and just come back the next day with lots of information. And he said he felt that you were that kind of guy as well. Is he right?
He's right on a certain point. But for me, it was always important then to calm down my brain. I had to stop then, thinking and discussing and everything and reading the notes, etc. And just got a feeling. I tried to make decisions also with intuition a little bit. Because sometimes you get crazy when you see all these numbers. And the
you can overthink it.
Yes, you can overthink it. And then sometimes I felt, no, it's too much now. I said to my race engineer, at this time it was called Walter Neher, Walter, stop. Doesn't help anymore. We cannot discuss it now again, back and forward. Leave it like it is. We tried like this.
And do you think the times when you were at your best was when you weren't looking at the data and you were just relying on instinct?
Relying on instinct, yes. But on the other hand, I needed also the information and the papers just to get confidence and knew what's going on. This I liked very much.
When you look at those early races in 94, I feel you took a step over the winter from 93 to 94. You know, you scored in two of the opening three races. Do you feel that you took a step forward?
Yes, and it started well. I felt confidence because there was Interlagos, the first race of the year in 1994. I was easily fourth, I think 8 or 9 laps before the end of the race, and then I got misfire and dropped back to 6. But it would have been already a good start of the season. I felt comfortable in the car. The 93 car, the first car of Sauber in Formula 1, was very competitive for a new team, but was all very sensitive from the aerodynamic. So different outside temperature, a bit more sun or less sun made the car handling different. And the 94 car was more stable from my point of view. And I liked this 94 car a lot. And I also had a little bit more space in the car because the 93 car was a bit tight for me.
So even with that seat fit in the wooden chassis,
yep,
at the end of 92.
Yeah, because, you know, it was a funny thing. I mean, I don't know if it was really like this, but Leo Res, the chief engineer, said, okay, you fit in the chassis now, looks good in this wooden chassis, yes. But which was not in the wooden chassis at this time was the fire extinguisher. And then they put the fire extinguisher in front of my bum and I couldn't move in so far anymore. A little bit. So it was a bit tight. And the 94 car was more comfortable for me to sit.
You had the world at your feet as we went in to Monaco 1994. Do you remember how you felt going into that race? Do you think a street track, this is somewhere where, you know, the driver is a little bit more important, you could argue. Did you go into that weekend feeling uber confident?
Yes. Because I had very good memories from 1993 with Sauber in Monaco. I was, I believe, seventh on the grid. I was on Saturday morning fourth fastest. The car was handling perfect. And then, as I said before, it was a bit more sensitive on the aerodynamics side. In the afternoon, it was a bit more outside temperature. It was more sun out, and then the grip was less, but still we were seventh on the grid. I believe I arrived with a good feeling in Monaco from my preparation and my thoughts about the car. On the other hand, we had this bad Imola weekend 10 days before, 2 weeks before, and this, of course, affected everything still a little bit, even when I tried to stay focused and don't think about Imola anymore. No? It was a good feeling in this Monaco weekend.
Carl, how did Imola affect you? Because you actually had a good race. You know, when the race was restarted, you got a good result.
I got a good result, but you know, I was at this time not the guy who could show emotions. Huh? I didn't realize really at Imola and after Imola, my head was confused. Huh? There were so many thoughts somehow jumping around. Huh? From outside, I looked quiet. Huh? I looked relaxed, but the inside, I wasn't. I don't know if there was any way, you know, to somehow calm down a little bit before Monaco or not. But I went there, and of course, there was always a little bit Imola in the background, what happened there.
Because, of course, Roland Ratzenberger lost his life on the Saturday of Imola, compatriot. Did you know Roland well?
Not so much, honestly, because Roland was around, I think, even nearly 10 years older than I was, and we were never together in any championship. I met him the first time, I believe, in 1992 in Le Mans. I did the guest start at Peugeot to earn a little bit of money because at March I couldn't earn anything. And he was there with a Toyota, and then we had a few minutes talk there. But this was the first time I met him, I believe, in 1992. Huh?
Just out of interest, did you know Senna at all? Had you had any conversations with Ayrton?
Very little. He came to me on the table in the Suzuka Circuit Hotel in a restaurant and said, "Welcome to Formula One." In 1991.
Your first race.
Yes,
he welcomed
you. I was very proud that he did this. And then between Mexico and Interlagos 1992, a group of guys, we went to Club Mate south of Rio de Janeiro, quite close to his house at Angra, I believe. And once he was in the Club Mate, Ayrton, and we had a talk there. For, I don't know, 2-3 minutes. He said, you do everything quite good. Try to improve a little bit, blah, blah, blah. And that was it. Otherwise, really, I didn't know him. No.
It is extraordinary that he looked out for you, even though, you know, in the March days, you weren't a threat to him on the racetrack. He was still very aware of your presence and also wanted to make you feel welcome.
Yes, he did.
So even though you didn't know either of the guys who'd been killed at Imola very well, did you very much feel that one of your kind, your brethren, you know, a fellow driver?
Absolutely. This Imola weekend was, when you look back now, it was very strange. There was Ruben's accident on Friday. The common opinion in the paddock was, look at Ruben. Bad accident, nothing can happen anymore. So Formula One is safe, huh? Nothing can happen anymore. And then when Roland Ratzenberger had his accident on Saturday, I was still sitting in the car. I watched it on the monitor. And I said, no, can't be. But it happened, because I saw him. I saw him sliding there and stopping and moving his head, and I said, fuck, can't be. And then Mr. Sauber said immediately, we stop the session, we go out of the car, we don't continue anymore. And then you had to discuss with yourself, probably the guy is dead. Huh? And the official announcement, I think, only came on 4:30 in the afternoon. Huh? My decision was quite clear. I want to continue racing. I never thought about stopping racing after Imola or after the Saturday accident of Roland. I want to continue. But still, staying focused and control the emotions was not easier.
And then how did Senna's death the following day affect you?
It confused me even more. I mean, I finished fourth. I went in the Parc Fermé, an Austrian journalist told me, bad accident in the pits. A Sauber mechanic got injured. But it was not a Sauber mechanic, it was a Ferrari mechanic, I believe Michele Alboreto lost the wheel or whatever. And I came in the pits and there were people crying. And then I said, is anybody hurt from us? So a mechanic said, no, Senna is dead. They said it immediately. Yeah? I think, I don't know if there was an official announcement already there. And then I said, fuck, can't be. Yeah? Because before the race stopped, I passed the place of the accident from Ayrton Senna once, then there was red flag. Then we had to stop at the start-finish line because at red flag, you don't go back to the pit lane, you stay at start-finish. And my race engineer came to me and I said to him, it's Williams. And he said, yeah, it's Senna, but he seems to be okay. either he just told it to me to keep me quiet, or this was the only information he got. Huh? And then after the race, the first thing I heard, Senna is dead. And I was said, oh, can't be, you know, you cannot control your thoughts anymore and emotions. And I had my best friend with me in Imola, and we were sitting on the floor, back on the wall in the garage, and he said to me, please stop with this shit, stop. Come with me home. Don't do any testing anymore. Stop. Two people are dead now here in 2 days. And I said, no, I continue.
That was your immediate reaction?
Immediate reaction. I was sad about what happened. I was nearly crying there without being able to show emotions, but it was a bit like that. But for me, it was an immediate decision. I want to continue racing.
You were 25 at the time. Had you thought about the safety side of motor racing at any point up till then?
No, not at all. Not at all. Because I knew that there is a certain kind of danger, of course, but you always believe nothing happens to you. Huh? Nothing bad happens to you. No, I knew that there's risk, of course, but I never had any minute thinking about the risk in racing. No.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com. So, Carl, first practice in Monaco. You are exiting the tunnel. Can you remember what happened next?
No, because the last thing I remember is going to bed on Wednesday evening.
Even now, don't remember
anything? No, nothing. And also on Wednesday, because at this time, Monaco first practice day was on the Thursday. The thing I remember from Wednesday is jogging or running at lunch, at Wednesday lunchtime, together with Heinz-Harald Frenzen, my teammate, and our physio, and dinner on Wednesday evening, and then going to bed. I don't know anything from the paddock, from any meeting, from any photograph session, from any talk with other drivers or engineers or journalists. I don't remember any seconds of driving.
When you look at the data, do you know what caused the accident?
No, really, the data didn't show us really why it happened. The data just showed that quite early after starting braking, I must have lost the car somehow. And we know the speed. I think the top speed was around 272 kilometers an hour. Then I started braking later than the laps before. But I also had a new set of tire at the end of the session. So maybe I wanted just to use the grip of the new set of tire. I was braking later. And I must have lost it quite early after start of braking, because the impact, what we saw on the telemetry, was still with 177 kilometers an hour. And you know, when you arrive with 270 and you brake a Formula One car for 2 seconds, you're down at 60 kilometers an hour. So must have been happened quite early after I started braking. But why, we don't know.
You were then in a coma for 3 weeks. In terms of your limbs, were there any broken bones?
No, there was nothing, no.
And when you look at video footage of the accident now, How does it make you feel?
I saw the video quite early when I still was in hospital here in Innsbruck. The last 3 weeks, they said you can go home on the weekend to get used a little bit to private life again. And the first thing I wanted to see was this video of the accident. And it was, yes, it was me, but it could have been a different guy as well because I have no memory. Yeah? In the beginning, I said, yes, it is like it is. I will never find out why it happened. Then I thought, wow, I would have been interested why I lose the car. But on this video, the car is already sideways and you don't see why it comes sideways. Huh?
And when you regained consciousness 19 days after the accident, what was your thought about racing? You say after the deaths at Imola, your first reaction was, I want to keep racing. What was your attitude towards racing then?
How can I say, to come back to life was quite slow. They reduced the coma, or they stopped the coma in Nice after 19 days. But what I know from my family is the first 2 days I didn't say anything, I didn't react to anything. Most of the time I was sleeping. Then a doctor down there asked me about my name, and I told him my name is Karl, I'm 25 years old, I'm Kufstein from Tirol. The next day they told me, I said, I'm Karl, I'm 12 years old, I'm from Kufstein in Tirol. They decided to bring me back here to Innsbruck, to the hospital, to get all the therapy done with the people from here. I don't remember the flight, but I was wake up in the medical chat. And even in Innsbruck, I don't remember, the first 7 or 9 days, where I already was talking, where I already got work with the therapists, where I already was, they were training my brain again. And the first memory I have, I was in the bed, looked around and thought, oh, it looks like a hospital. But I didn't know why, yeah. And then I think quite soon, a few minutes later, my mother was coming in the room again, and I asked her, mother, what I'm doing here. So it seems to be a hospital. And then they slowly but surely explained me. But still now, I don't remember anything.
So you don't remember anything. But when did you start to feel normal, if that's the right word?
I would say the last weeks or the whole July. I got released from the hospital, I believe, on the 30th of July, and the July was already good. And the good thing was, with the good work the therapist did there every day for many hours, I felt every day better. I didn't have pain, but for example, the short-time memory and everything to become independent again, to do your own things, to go in the bathroom in the morning and brush my teeth on my own and everything worked. And then I felt, yeah, it feels good. It feels better. It made me thinking quite soon I can have my own independent life again. Huh?
So independent life, what about a racing life?
Also, there I would say the whole July, I said, I want to continue racing. Because the doctor said to my parents, don't ask him, wait until he starts this matter again about motor racing. And then I said once to the doctor, when can I go home? And I said, not now. Why? Because I want to get fit to get to do racing again. Huh? It was like a little child, you know. I want to do racing again. Maybe this also accelerated a little bit the improvement, that I got better and better. On the other hand, I was so far away from being really fit and normal again, because I remember in the hospital once a nurse came and said, okay, now we have to go and to the weighbridge. It showed 62 kilos. And I said to her, no, this one is broken because I have 76.
That's your fighting weight, 76.
Yeah. And then she said, no, this one is not broken. You have 62 and not 76. Because there was no muscle anymore. I was thin like a skeleton. But still, I wanted to go out. And then I got released on the 30th. And I said then, at home, where is my bicycle? I want to go cycling. I have to get fit. Then I went to Professor Willy Dungel. And I was, 4 weeks at Willy, and then, to build up my body again. Huh?
I'll come on to Willy Dungel in a second. I did want to ask how much contact you had with Peter Sauber in particular at that period. Did he come and see you? Did he keep the seat open for you? Because I think Andrea De Cesaris had replaced you in the car, but what did he say to you?
I mean, the relationship with the Sauber team, with Mr. Sauber and with the Mercedes people was very, very good. They supported me a lot. They supported my family. They looked immediately if there is a special doctor somewhere around the world, but then they got told if I'm in the hand of Mr. or Professor Grimaud in Nice, I'm in the best hands anyway. But, there was big support. I think Mr. Sauber, 1 or 2 weeks after the accident, he came with his wife to Nice to visit me. I was still in coma. And then he said to me, Karl, when you get fit again, when you get able again to drive racing cars, the door is still open at Hinwil. No, the relationship was very good and they did a lot for me.
And tell us now then, some of the things that Willy Dungel got you to do to get yourself back in shape? Get those, what is it, 14 kilos that you'd lost back on?
Okay, he made a diet plan, what I have to eat. And I was there, you know, and there was a lot of therapy works also underwater on magnetic, different kind of computer machines, whatever, and fitness training, of course. Huh? But in the beginning, I couldn't run. I only could do some bicycle training because the only thing which got next to my head also insured was the left knee. The knee got an operated beginning of September, and then the knee was also okay. So this in August, I tried to get fitter again, I got stronger, but I was still a little bit limited from the left knee. And I did a lot of things with Willy. He even went with me with a bicycle on the road next to his hotel there in Gars am Kamp. And then he said, we came back after an hour, and he said, looks good from the fitness and also from the head. Because when you watched me all the time taking the risk between the trucks and not getting crashed from the trucks, and you still could manage to do this for 1 hour, then you improved a lot already, he said. Willy was a great guy. And, you know, because my knee was insured, in 5 in the morning, he came into my room and put already a cream on my left knee to get it better. So he was there all day long.
Fully committed.
Yeah.
But how much of the recuperation was physical, and how much did he help you mentally as well?
Physically, more or less. Mentally, not really. This somehow, with a good work in the hospital here in Innsbruck, it was already on a very good level when I got released from the hospital. But then they said it will improve just with the daily use, to remember things, to decide things, etc. This came on his own then. Huh?
So what about getting back in a car? Just talk us through that process and what you did first.
Of course, I didn't know how it really will be to be back in a Formula One car again, but I believed end of August or beginning of September, I had a test day with a Porsche Cup car on the Salzburgring to get used again to drive a racing car. And in the beginning, they told me it looked like slow motion, huh? But I didn't recognize it because I was so slow. Somehow they believe, fuck, this is the end now. If he keeps on driving so slow, the career is over. But this was just getting used to. The end of the day, I did quite competitive times then. Huh? And then Sauber invited me, I believe, end of September again, or middle of September, to come to Le Castellet and be again in the Formula One car for test day.
How difficult was it to get back in the car?
It was not so difficult. Okay, Heinz Harald was there making a lap time. And then I did 10 laps. And then unfortunately, it started to rain. At the end of these 10 laps, I believe I was around 2 seconds slower than Heinz Harald, which is a lot. On the other hand, if you after this injury and out of the car for months, it was even not so much, huh? Because maybe with a whole day of driving, I could have been quite close to him again. But then after 10 laps of driving, it started to rain. Then we continued driving or testing in the rain, and then the test was over. The memory of the driving was still there. And so it was not such a big deal again to get used to it again, huh?
So, you know, we were talking about instinct earlier. The instinct was still there.
It was still there. Now I could not do this anymore. The brain is okay, I believe, but I could not do this anymore, not at all. Huh? Because I would not fit enough. I would be not fast enough in the reaction, not fast enough in my eyes. But there, even after this bad injury, the instinct was still there.
So you go to Barcelona next to drive the car in the dry, very different layout to Paul Ricard as well. How was that test?
There were two tests in Barcelona. The first test was, I believe, in October, because they said maybe you can drive the last two races of the season. This test was not good because I had a big pain in my head and neck. This was okay for Le Castellet, for flat surface. But with all these bad bumps in Barcelona, I had big pain in my head. And then we had to stop this test session after 1 day. And I said, sorry, I cannot continue. I have so much pain. Huh? And then they said, okay, but then maybe it doesn't look so good for 1995 because we need to know if you still are able to drive a car on a competitive way. And then there was another test beginning of December in 1994, and Heinz Harald was there again. We shared the car. The pain in my head was less, but it was still a little bit there with the bumps, but I could manage to do it. And the lap times were quite good compared to the Heinz Harald. I don't know if he showed everything what he could show, but I was concentrated, I was consistent, I was quite fast because there were two other guys again fighting for this cockpit for 1995 then, but I was quite a lot faster than they were. So everything looked quite good.
Did you do a race distance that time?
No, race distance not. No, in and out, always again, a few laps. Huh? They were just actually, it mattered a bit at this time on the lap times. Is he still able to be somehow competitive or not? And at this time, it looked quite good. Even Heinz Harald said to me, but it was good. Huh? It was good, competitive. And we looked at the data, and to him, it was not so much different. I think he was 0.3 seconds faster than I was, so it was good. This test was the reason why I got then a contract for 1995 again. Huh?
And then you get to test over the winter as preparation for the 95 season. You still felt sharp?
No.
What happened?
I don't know. The first test with the new car, with the 1995 car, I believe was in Barcelona, beginning of February. And my whole ability, everything was gone. I couldn't concentrate anymore. I couldn't drive this car. I didn't feel well. I was not good. I was not fast enough. I went back to the doctors, here to the professor in the hospital, and I explained to him, and he said, you know what, your injury was so heavy that for a normal life it's okay. But if you maybe have to show these extreme performances and concentration, everything, maybe you're not far enough yet. Huh?
But that second Barcelona test, you said, went well, and the instinct was there, you were quick.
Everything was there. I came home and said to my father, if this Monaco has one good thing, then I'm better than before. And he said, why that? I said, this was so easy down there, these 2 or 3 days. I felt well. I felt good. I was competitive. Everything was okay.
So, Carl, how do you explain the downturn over the winter of 94, 95?
I cannot explain, and I never got an answer for this.
Did you ever discuss it with Willy Dungal?
With Willy, yes. And he tried to also try to help, but it was too late. And I did the first 4 races. I was not good enough. I wasn't competitive enough. I got replaced from Jean-Marc Gounon. And then, okay, they said to me, you can do some testing, do it a year, find back to your performance. And then maybe, and then the test session I did in October in Mugello was good. And then they said, okay, come to the last 2 races. But this was bad again. And this was my end of career. Maybe my Formula One time somehow was finished. And this was then just a confirmation for it.
But that test at Mugello, late in 95, did you feel like you had done in Barcelona?
Yes.
Almost a year earlier?
Yes, I was there again. I was focused. I was sharp. I was fast. My only problem a little bit is this year in 1995 was the car was a little bit overweight. It was the first year from the rules that minimum weight was car and driver together, because until 1995 it was just minimum weight the car and not. And this was the first time that the minimum weight car and driver together. But unfortunately the car was overweight and I was a lot heavier than Heinz Harald, so I drove around with around 18 to 20 kilos more weight than he does, which is quite a lot in Formula One. Yeah?
5 tenths.
Yes, but okay, I had a lot more distance to him, but then I had concentration problems. It was just not working anymore. But still, the test in Mugello then, I was concentrated, I was focused, I was on the point, and this was the reason why they said, okay, come to Suzuka to the and Adelaide the last 2 races. But maybe I was nervous, maybe I was whatever. The performance was not good, and that was it then. I was just not fast enough.
Did you know, as you flew out of Australia after that last race of 95, that the Formula One part of your career was over?
Yes, I noticed so.
You'd had that conversation with Peter Sauber?
Yes, I had.
How long did it take you to come to terms with that?
Easy, soon. I don't know why. It would have been a big drama for me with not being able to get the comeback, huh? This would have destroyed me mentally completely. But then I tried it. I got the chance. I couldn't confirm it with good performance. And then Adelaide was bad again. And then Mr. Sauber said, that's it. And I had to accept it. And that was it. I did not argue one time about this anymore, I believe. Because in my head, it was, okay, I had to accept it. It didn't work again. Maybe it has a reason, maybe not. It didn't work. And that's it.
Did you ever feel like you did pre-accident in a racing car again?
Yes, absolutely. I felt the same in a racing car 3 years after. This Barcelona test in 1994 was very good. This Mugello test in 1995 was very good, but it was not consistent. And then in 96 and 97, I got the contract with Audi for a 2-liter saloon car championship in Germany, in Italy. 1996, it was a race was good, the next one was bad. Or practice was good, the next one was bad. And then in 1997, at least I could use my potential all the time. If this potential was enough or not, this is one question. But I could use my potential always. And this was the same then like before the accident.
You finish on the podium at Le Mans in 1996. Mentally, one of the hardest races you can do. How tough was that race? Do you feel you drove a good race there?
No. If you ask me for the worst race in my career, I think it was 1996 Le Mans. I could not handle this car. I got a contract from Audi with a 2-liter saloon car championship, and I did already some testing, and I had to change my driving style completely from Formula 1 to a 2-liter saloon car with little horsepower and a lot of weight. And at the same time, I had to get used to this Porsche car, and I couldn't do the same thing. I couldn't do both. I was bad, actually, honestly. I was driving bad. I think there was a double stint in the night. I was competitive, but I was not good enough. You know, sometimes you meet racing cars in your career where you have problem with the characteristic of this car. And this 1996 Porsche was a bit like this. Huh?
So which was the car in your career that you felt happiest driving?
I would say the Sauber Mercedes C11.
Sports car.
The sports car, the still the turbo. The C291 was also, I felt well in the car. The March Formula 1. This car fitted really to my driving style and everything. The Sauber 1994, even with the accident I had, but the 1994 car, I felt well. Later on, then Aston Martin GT1 in 2007, 2008, I felt well inside them.
What's become apparent during our conversation is your career is a case of what might have been, in that you had the raw ability, you had Mercedes backing behind you, you were going really well at the start of 94. Is there any bitterness in you?
It sounds maybe strange, but it never was, because somehow I got the impression this is my way of life. And somehow a great Formula One career was not part of my life. And this was why the accident happened in Monaco, and this was why I couldn't manage to do a good comeback. Huh?
And so when you look at the career of Michael Schumacher, the 7 World Championships, even the career of Heinz Harald, your two contemporaries on the Mercedes Junior program. You're fine, you're happy for them for the success they had.
Absolutely. And I watched them, of course. I followed their career, also their Formula One career a lot. And especially Michael always again impressed me. I always had the feeling he can improve himself always again, somehow, however he did it. Huh? No. I was happy for them. I'm still happy for them, what they achieved. No, there was never any
jealousy?
No, jealousy, no, never, no.
Carl, who was the best driver you came up against in your career?
Michael.
And that was apparent from when you were teammates at Sauber Mercedes sports cars, or are you looking at the sort of the bigger picture of Michael?
I look at the bigger picture, actually. Because he was, of course, he was always competitive, he was always fast, he was always motivated, focused, fit, etc. In Group C times, yes, at the sports car time, it was still possible to beat him in practice session. I mean, he was not out of, to reach him. But what impressed me by Michael, like I said before, this long time he showed this performance, and always got the impression that always he improves again somehow. Yeah.
Some people have said to me that Michael wasn't the fastest of the three of you over one lap. Would you agree? Who do you think was the fastest of the three of you?
It depends a bit on the testing day. Heinz Harald shaked it out a little bit of his hand, very easy. Yeah. Michael was focused very much, and sometimes I was also fast.
You were very fast. And who on the current grid reminds you of you?
Of me?
Go on, you're going to say Max Verstappen.
No, he's too good. He's too good to remind me on me. No, everybody's different.
I've got a name I'd like to suggest, but is there anyone that comes to mind when you look at the current grid?
Not immediately.
I look at Carlos Sainz.
Maybe yes. He's fast, competitive, but still a bit
very technical.
Quiet, technical, yeah.
Yeah. Would you agree? Is that a good name?
It's a good name.
Have I done well?
Okay. No, it's a good name. It's a good name. Absolutely.
Well, Carl, it has been fantastic to have you on the show. Thank you very much for your time. I've loved looking back through the history books of your career. There is one thing before you go. We have some quick fire questions just to end the interview. First up, what are you bad at?
Sorry?
You're a brilliant racing driver. What are you bad at?
Cooking.
Cooking. What is your signature dish? Is there one?
No, I like to eat, but not to cook.
All right. What about this one? Which racing driver would you want to be stuck in a lift with?
I mean, he's unfortunately not alive anymore. Ayrton Senna.
Who would play you in a film?
Pete Sampras.
He's not an
actor. He's not an actor. A few times in the past, 1996, I was at the Olympic Games in Atlanta with a group of Audi people. And I think 3 times people came to me in shopping center. Hey, Pete, can I get an autograph? I said, sorry, not beat. So, I mean, no, who can blame me? I don't know.
Who is the coolest person in your address book?
You will not know him. He's a guy, he works for the AMG Experience at events, and he's the best guy ever. Because he managed everything you need.
Everyone needs a man like that.
Yeah, that's it, exactly.
Who would be your first guest if you hosted a podcast like this?
Alain Prost.
Carl, thank you very much for your time.
Yes, thank you very much.
A Pete Sampras lookalike. Now you mention it, Carl, yes. But thank you for your time, Carl. What an inspiration you are. You are a brilliant racing driver, and yet there's no hint of bitterness about what happened at Monaco 30 years ago. There's no jealousy when you look at the success of the other drivers on the Mercedes Junior program. You're an extraordinary man. I loved hearing Carl's story, and I'll head down to the Nouvelle Chicane while at Monaco this week and pause for a moment to think about what might have been had Carl not had that accident. I believe he was that good. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Carl as well. Please let me know what you think through all the usual channels, as you did after last week's show with Martin Brundle. We had loads of feedback about Martin, and this one stood out for me. I could never understand why he never got more out of his Formula One career, says Gert Pullman. Now I know. Having such a handicap at this level is a big thing. What a shame. I think we learnt a lot, didn't we, Gert? Well, that's almost it for this week. A couple of parish notices before I go. F1 Nation's review of the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix is out now. I'm joined by a truly international cast of Colombian journalist Diego Meyer and Italian Andrea Cremonesi. Both were excellent in their explanations of what went on at Imola. And the latest episode of F1 Explains is out now with Ruth Buscombe and Bernie Collins. I'll, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. But for now, thanks for listening. Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out. 2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda Racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at Honda.com.
From a meeting at the office to a big first day, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every event. But clothes don't make the man. So why stuff your closet with things that only work for some situations? With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting. Their clothing is understated and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They craft each piece by combining timeless style and modern performance materials, so you can stay looking good and feeling comfortable from morning to evening. No wardrobe changes required. Browse everything from summer-ready tech linen shorts and anti-odor polos to tailored sweats and crews for a night in. They can outfit you for anything, no matter what's on your agenda for the day. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.